21-5297 USA versus Alex Jackson. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Ms. Green for the appellant.
Ms. Green, if you would tell us how much time you need for rebuttal, and then you can proceed.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Molly Rose Green, and I represent the appellant, Alex Jackson. The two issues presented here both separately resulted in an unlawful conviction for Mr. Jackson. I'd like to start out today discussing his second argument, the insufficient proof of possession of a gun shown at trial. In particular, the lack of proof that he intended to exercise dominion and control over the gun. Mere presence in a car with a firearm, or even presence in a car with an illegal possessor of a firearm, is not sufficient proof of constructive possession. The evidence in the record shows that the gun was tied to the passenger, Mr. Webster, and lacked a nexus with Mr. Jackson. The passenger's quick departure.
Ms. Green, how do we know it's tied with the passenger? How do we know that?
So the only person that was seen handling the gun was the passenger.
Okay, that doesn't mean there can't be joint possession, does it?
There certainly could be joint possession. Joint possession is, you know, possible. Two people can have possession over the same gun.
Okay, so the fact that the one passenger handled it doesn't exclude the possibility of constructive possession by your client. That's all I agree.
There are, you know, multiple ways the government could have shown proof of constructive possession, that additional incriminating evidence apart from mere presence, that would show that Mr. Jackson had that intention to exercise dominion and control. And they failed to do so in this case, which is why there was insufficient proof of his conviction. Mr. Jackson was alone in the Jeep for just a few seconds before his arrest. So that puts this case somewhere in between a sole occupant case and a multiple occupant case. And during the few seconds he was alone with the gun, he continued to give no indication of any intention to exercise control or dominion over the firearm.
It's hard to imagine a convicted felon would knowingly ride around in a vehicle with a rifle, knowing the understanding, as he should, the consequences of being stopped to himself if he stopped with a rifle in his vehicle. There's almost a presumption that he's attached to or related to a firearm that he has in his vehicle. What would you say to that argument?
I agree with you that if we're examining what, you know, was this a very smart decision? Perhaps not. But under the law of the Sixth Circuit, there isn't a presumption that because he was in the car with a firearm, he constructively possessed it. The law is clear and repeatedly says that mere possession is not enough. Additional incriminating evidence of intent to exercise dominion and control over that firearm is required.
To whom did the firearm belong? Whose rifle was that?
There's no evidence in the record of to whom the firearm was registered. Mr. Webster did plead guilty to possession of the same firearm, but again, no evidence in the record of the official owner.
Ms. Green, I think you've got a pretty good argument to the jury that maybe the jury should find him not guilty of it. But at this point, the jury already did find your client guilty of felon in possession of the firearm. So our standard of review at this point, is it not that we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government? And whether doing so could support the conviction?
Certainly the sufficiency of the evidence is a tough standard to meet. But as the court said in Grubbs, it's not toothless review. The court still must look to whether the judgment was supported by substantial and confident, competent evidence. And in addition, while we know juries can make inferences, the court's role, even under sufficiency of the evidence review, is to examine whether those inferences are rational, which the court discussed in Arnold. And we can see from specifically Bailey, although also Smith and Bermley, the court, you know, has reversed jury verdicts on constructive possession when the jury there was not evidence in addition to mere possession to support.
You mean presence? You said possession a couple times, but you actually mean
mere presence. I appreciate right. that. Definitely not mere possession. Yeah.
I have one question, but first of all, I would say that Molly was my clerk in 2016 and was a very good clerk, and we welcome her to this court. But I have a hard question for you. What role does the statement made by Mr. Jackson play about the rifle itself when he indicated knowledge of the rifle by saying, "Oh, I thought the passenger who jumped out of my car took a rifle with him"? That's a pretty hard statement to buy in when you consider the size of the rifle as a weapon and the passenger jumping out of the car and running away visibly without any weapon. What role does that play?
That statement does not provide enough evidence to sustain this conviction. And first, I'll just note that Mr. Jackson's statement wasn't stated in a certain way. You know, he said, "I don't know, I think." But regardless of whether the statement was absolutely true or not, regardless of if he was being evasive or not at that moment, that statement still doesn't show any intent to exercise dominion or control over the gun. The intent is still missing. And the context in which he made that statement, Mr. Jackson is in handcuffs being put into the police car when he's asked these questions. So his stop and his compliance with the deputy's commands in answering questions, those all show evidence of him turning over the gun. He's, you know, the gun is in the car. The officer's going to find it, and he has stopped and complied. So the court still needs evidence of the intent. And here we see the placement of the gun is different than cases where it's directly under the driver's seat. Mr. Jackson has a kitten in his lap. The deputy lets his wife come and pick up the kitten. So the knowledge here does not equal an intent to exercise dominion and control. And I think a hypothetical might be helpful here. If I'm driving and my passenger has their cell phone, or if we want to think of something more along the size of a rifle, maybe the passenger has their guitar with them. As a driver, I know that that item is in the car. But if they get out quickly, leaving that item behind their seat, that doesn't mean that I have the intention to exercise dominion and control over that item. So why is it that when the item is an illegal item, a contraband, we change the way we think about intent? We impute a nefarious intent because the item is a gun, but we wouldn't assume the driver's intent to use their passenger's cell phone or guitar left behind just because they left it in the car a few seconds ago. The government still had to put on evidence of Mr. Jackson's specific intent, and it failed to do so. Mr. Jackson had been, I'm just going to address briefly the kind of where we're situated between a sole occupant case and a multiple occupant case. If Mr. Jackson had been alone in the car the entire time from the start and had knowledge of the gun, similar to the Newsom case, potentially we would have a different situation right now. But this case is between sole occupant and multiple occupant. And in that scenario, knowledge doesn't mean as much here when the direct evidence we have associates the item with the passenger. Mr. Jackson was the sole occupant of the car for just a few seconds. So to hold that the evidence in this case is sufficient would create a somewhat different but still problematic strict liability regime like the court discussed in Bailey, where a passenger could bail out of a car, leaving a driver with criminal responsibility for an item he has demonstrated no intention to actually use or exercise dominion and control over.
Doesn't he have the ability to exercise control over it because the truck is registered in his wife's name, that in effect it's his vehicle and he knows that that rifle is there? I mean, it, least we know it's 45 minutes or something. It's not like the passenger brought the rifle in quickly and he didn't have really times to say, you know, get that rifle out of my vehicle or anything. I mean, he knows it's there. He's in charge of the vehicle. He's in control of the vehicle. And the jury's asked whether you can make a reasonable inference. Also, the prosecution didn't have to present direct evidence of his possession and control, but a reasonable inference that he had the ability to control and possess it. Why isn't that enough?
To first address the issue of dominion, the fact that it was his car and he was driving the car, that fact is not sufficient to establish dominion and control. And we know that from Bailey and Craven. He had non-exclusive possession of the car. There was a passenger in it for the majority of the time. The car also belonged to his wife. So even when you have a situation where there's non-exclusive possession of the premises, here the Jeep, the dominion is not sufficient to establish control over the firearm, or rather the fact that he was driving is not sufficient there. This situation had no testimony, unlike other cases, no testimony from the passenger saying it wasn't his, no testimony from the wife saying it wasn't hers.
Okay.
Well, you know, he's in his vehicle with a firearm. If he had had that firearm with him in his house, in his home, would your argument be the same, that he couldn't be charged or convicted as a felon with a firearm, because even though the firearm was in his home, that doesn't mean it belonged to him?
The argument would be the same if there were no additional evidence, no nexus tying him to that firearm. If there had been other people there, it was brought in and handled by a different person. If those situations were the same, then yes, the argument would be similar in the house. See that language. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, it's hard to believe that a felon would be permitted to keep firearms in his home, even though he might claim that those firearms did not belong to him. Same thing in his car. It's sort of hard to believe he could, with impunity, keep firearms in his car and not be charged just by claiming that the firearms didn't belong to him.
Certainly, but there may be a difference here between what could constitute, for example, a violation of probation versus what is, under the Sixth Circuit case law, constructive possession. And the law is clear that even for a felon, mere presence with the gun is not enough. And I see my time is up. So unless there are further questions, I'll stop.
All right. You have your rebuttal time. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'll begin with the sufficiency issue, since that's what the discussion is focused on so far. The government presented evidence in this case that after suspiciously and continuously circling the Duck River Market with a firearm in his car for 45 minutes, defendant Alex Jackson unsuccessfully attempted to flee law enforcement and to conceal the weapon from the investigating officer. That evidence was sufficient to sustain his conviction of constructive possession. And the United States.
How did Jackson try to conceal the weapon?
When he was pulled over by the investigating officer, the officer asked him whether the weapon was in the car or had been taken by Corey Webster. Jackson responded that it had been taken by Corey Webster, but there is evidence in the record that the firearm was so large that it would be implausible to think that Jackson could have reasonably believed it to have gone with Webster when he ran without Jackson having seen it. And the jury could have reasonably credited that testimony.
Okay, how's that concealing the weapon?
Your Honor, I mean concealing in a non sort of physical sense. He lied to the officer about the weapon's continued presence in his car.
Okay, so all right, so he lies to the officer, and how does that establish constructive possession?
Your Honor, the appellant has attempted to place this case within the ambit of mere presence cases, but as those cases have consistently acknowledged, evidence of evasive conduct indicates it is the type of additional fact above and beyond mere presence that can support a constructive possession conviction.
Yes,
and
here, evidence of guilt is evasive conduct, or okay.
Your Honor.
It really is a pretty weak constructive possession case, is it not? I mean,
respectfully, Your Honor, the government doesn't believe so. I think this court's decision in Burmley is instructive in that Burmley illustrates the sort of spectrum of circumstantial evidence that can support a constructive possession conviction. In Burmley, there were three defendants who were arrested in a vehicle with a firearm in the trunk. The first defendant, against whom the evidence was strongest, had been recorded making certain calls to a government informant regarding the firearm. He was the owner of the car, but not the driver, and his conviction was sustained. Then as to the second defendant, who I think is especially illustrative here, that defendant was the driver, but not the owner of the car. And the sole additional circumstantial evidence of constructive possession beyond his driving the car was that he was found with a key in his pocket, giving him access to the trunk of the car where the firearm was found. So those two facts alone, the fact that he was driving a car that wasn't his own with a firearm in the trunk, and that he had access to the part of the car where the firearm was found to be sufficient by this court to sustain his conviction for constructive possession. Now, the third defendant against whom the evidence was weakest was merely a passenger in the car. There was no specific evidence tying him to the transaction that the first defendant had planned. There's no evidence that he specifically had access to the gun. And that was deemed by this court to be insufficient. And so I think if we place this case on that spectrum, the evidence against defendant Jackson here falls somewhere between the first and second defendant, against both against whom the convictions for constructive possession were sustained.
Does it matter that they never took any, they never had any fingerprints found, they never even tried to find any fingerprints? The weapon was not in the place that would logically be accessible to the driver, because where they're from and where I'm from, the person would never place the barrel, the business end of a gun, at the access point for the person who wants to use it. The stock of the gun would have been behind the driver had it been the driver's gun, but that's not true here. What do you have to say about the fact that there was never even an effort to check the finger or fingerprint the rifle to show a connection?
Your Honor, this court has repeatedly rejected the notion that finding a fingerprint is a necessary prerequisite to a constructive possession charge. I mean, physical control or physical contact with the gun isn't even itself an element of the crime. And so I don't think it's relevant here that there wasn't a fingerprint on the firearm. I mean, for example, in Arnold, I think it was the court found that it was not significant that there hadn't been fingerprints found on the firearm, even though the lack of fingerprints was inconsistent with the government's specific theory of the case in that case. Here, the government's theory of the case doesn't depend on a determination that Mr. Jackson ever physically handled the gun. And so I think the absence of fingerprints on the gun is irrelevant here. Further, as to the gun's placement in the car, there's testimony that the gun would have been easily accessible to the driver in the front seat. And so I don't think the fact of the particular direction in which the gun was placed would preclude a jury finding or any reasonable juror finding on these facts that the evidence was sufficient to convict. If I can sort of push back briefly on two contentions that the appellant made. I think the appellant has attempted to put this case squarely within the ambit of so-called multiple occupant cases rather than single occupant cases. We would contest that sort of characterization. Not only was there an extended period of time where Mr. Jackson was one of multiple occupants in the car with knowledge of the gun's presence, but also there was a period of time when he was the sole occupant. And though it was fleeting, it was a period of time during which he knew that the firearm was in his vehicle, and the officer, upon asking him whether it remained in the vehicle, he falsely said it was not. And so I don't think that characterization is right. But even if that characterization were correct, as Burnley illustrates in my discussion with Judge Griffin before, there's no categorical sort of distinction between multiple occupant cases and single occupant cases that would preclude the jury determining that beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Jackson was guilty here. And finally, appellant also noted that there was sort of no independent conduct after the defendant's arrest here that would indicate any connection with the gun. But as our discussion, as I've covered today in our discussion, he did attempt to tell the responding officer that the firearm was no longer in the car. And I do believe that that constitutes independent conduct. And so I think that those characterizations by appellant are misplaced. And if the court has no further questions, we're happy to rest on our brief.
I have none.
I have none. Mm-hmm. All right. We can hear Thank rebuttal you. At this time. Is there any rebuttal? I think you're...
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I can hear you now.
I'll briefly start with a quick discussion of flight. I believe it is appropriate for the court to look at the nature of what the government describes as flight and what we contend is not flight. So I'd just like to highlight the video, which shows the sergeant traveling a short distance, not speeding, leaning back, one hand on the wheel, almost a leisurely drive. So this certainly...
Excuse me, counsel, you're addressing the issue of suppression.
No, Your Honor. I'm addressing the government's argument that Mr. Jackson's evasive conduct may be considered in his constructive possession.
All right.
Mr. Jackson stopped the Jeep at the home where Mr. Webster lived, and that's where the Jeep stopped. I briefly would just touch on Burnley and Arnold and state that both of those cases showed the government provided more evidence of constructive possession than we have here. So in Burnley, the car was stopped as part of an investigated sting for the sale of firearms. So there was a reason there and more evidence that the individual who had the key to the trunk had constructive possession. And again, as well in Arnold, Mr. Arnold had been seen threatening an individual with a handgun just moments or minutes before he was arrested. So in closing, the district court stated that this was one of the weakest cases it had ever seen. And the jury questions show, while they are not evidence, they show that the jury did have trouble understanding constructive possession. And this highlights the weakness of the case. Even though the jury came away from the questions and answers convicting Mr. Jackson, that doesn't mean that the evidence was sufficient. So we ask that the district court's ruling on suppression be reversed, and also that Mr. Jackson's conviction be overturned. Thank you.
Now, you're not claiming that your client did not know that the gun was in the car. You're not making that assertion, are you?
That's correct. We believe
So you're admitting that he knew the gun was in the car, right?
It's certainly probable that he knew the gun was in the car, yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. There's nothing further. The case is submitted, and you counsel may unplug with their devices if they like, and the clerk may call. Well, there are no more cases, so I guess that completes our call of cases for the day. And at this point, court may be adjourned.